to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, the world just keeps getting smaller and smaller. Microtechnology now promises such wonders as the medical lab on a chip and implants that communicate on a wireless plane. That's just some of the exciting stuff Dr. Graham Julian has on his plate as the new ICOR chair at the University of Calgary. And over in the photochemistry lab, Dr. Cooper Langford is promoting a new technology using the sun to destroy toxic organic substances in air and water. And stepping back in time, a water story of a different kind, the Brooks Aqueduct. Historian David Finch relates the amazing tale of this one-of-a-kind engineering marvel in southern Alberta. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. During my own lifetime, miniaturization seemed to start with the transistor radio. Then there was wristwatch TVs, and now mini-disc recorders. But for those involved in electronics and computer engineering, the world quite literally dances on the head of a pin. That's just the environment that encapsulates the life and work of Dr. Graham Julian. He occupies the new ICOR Research Chair in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Calgary. I couldn't help but ask what enticed him to pick up his roots and move to Alberta.
Well, I was at the University of Windsor in southern Ontario for 31 years, and the opportunity presented itself. Alberta basically is funding infrastructure support for modern high technology. A lot of new opportunities here, chance to interact with new people, and I weighed the pros and cons, and I came down on the side of taking the job and moving here.
As the ICOR chair, what exactly will you be doing?
Well, my mandate is to set up a world-class research lab in, I'd call it integrated microsystems. The official name of the lab is Advanced Technology Information Processing Systems. As you can probably imagine from that title, it pretty well leaves me to do you know, a lot of different things, and that's what I intend to do. And some of those things I already think I know what they're going to be. Others, I do not. I mean, we'll see what happens.
Well, one of the things I've heard about is something called a lab on a chip. What's that?
Well, lab on a chip is actually trying to get what used to be a set of laboratory tests that would be done on the bench, let's say, or in the lab, either medical tests or what have you, to bring those down to the, let's say, the level of where you can hold one of these things in your hand, or even lower than that, perhaps down to the level of just measuring these things over a few millimeters. It involves an interaction of a lot of different disciplines. Obviously, the biochemistry disciplines associated with the original experimentation, but also the microelectronic and microstructure disciplines that are being used to fabricate these particular devices, actually to take what used to be a set of test tubes or electrophoresis slides or what have you, and actually bring them down to a level where they're just a few millimeters in size.
So this isn't necessarily something that gets injected into the body, but it's would be like a computerized device or something along those ideas. So, like, if we think back to Star Trek and what Dr.
McCoy, if I remember.
Yes. and Dr. McCoy's tricorder, is that the sort of thing that we're looking at?
Well, you know, science fiction does have a habit of eventually coming true, I suppose. Well, they were far-thinking people, I guess, back in the 60s, Gene Roddenberry, when he wrote this. But, yeah, I suppose the tricorder, in a sense, you know, we're all starting to look at maybe how would we produce something like a tricorder. And essentially, what did a tricorder do? It was sort of instant analysis, right, of the body, wave this thing over the body, and was instant analysis. I think we're some way away from that, but at least I think we can get a sort of medical analysis, you know, done a lot more efficiently by going to these smaller devices.
What other applications would that particular system have?
Well, biomedical analysis is normally where a lab on a chip is, you know, is structured, is pointed towards. But in terms of health sciences and the sorts of applications that micro-sized devices can bring, I mean, there are a huge wealth of these. I've worked for several years with my colleagues back at Windsor on hearing instruments. We'd call them hearing aids. We're working with a company, Genom Corporation in Burlington, who actually have something like 70% of the world's silicon in the canal hearing aids. So these are hearing aids that go right inside the ear. So that we're not talking about hearing aids that sit around the ear or maybe you have processors hanging on one's belt or whatever, but these are hearing aids that go right inside the ear. Therefore, they have to be small, and they have to be very low power, and obviously they have to do a good job as well, right? So we have been examining this sort of application, and this has taken us to something called microelectromechanical systems, which are small mechanical devices that are down at the... You can measure them in millionths of meters, actually probably measuring the total devices in millimeters. Obvious ones in a hearing aid, of course, are microphones. And we've started to look at integrating those with silicon, with the incredible amount of processing power that's now available in a little sliver of silicon. And in fact, that integration of those sorts of microelectro devices with microelectromechanical devices with the processing power of silicon also is leading us in Calgary here now to look at other applications of this.
What are some of the other areas that you'd be working with? Because you're talking about the medical sciences, but you're not a medical doctor or a researcher in those areas.
No.
And yet it seems what you have to do is bring together all these different technologies and ideas.
I think this is what I like to do, and I like to learn new things. And it's true, I don't really know right now. I don't have that expertise. I haven't spent 2 or 3 decades looking at, you know, sort of bioengineering, biomedical applications. But I'm surrounded by people who have. And I think the trick here is to bring these, perhaps we call them disparate technologies, together. And I think that's what I can do. I mean, I've done it at the past, back at my old university, and I think there's some incredible gains to be achieved by doing that here. I mean, there's another project that a colleague, Dr. Minchev, at the University of Calgary in the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department here, he's actually working with colonic sort of motility problems. And we want to talk about the results of these on this program, but these are major problems for people. And he is actually looking at electrical stimulation procedures for recovering, you know, these problems, getting people back to normal. And what we're now looking at is that he sort of does it on the basis of right now implanted electrodes and external processors and that type of thing. We're actually looking, is it feasible to implant micro devices right where they're needed to re-stimulate, say, colonic muscles or stomach muscles? That might be a possibility. And actually implant intelligent electrodes inside the body that can talk to each other over a wireless local area network. I mean, there are some incredible things that one can think of. I mean, maybe this is science fiction. Maybe I can't do this. I don't know. But, hey, let's have a shot at this.
Is there the chance that as this takes off and there's all this wireless communication and we've got all these little things either implanted in us or all about us, that we might get our wires crossed in that sense? Sending the wrong communications to the wrong part of the body or the wrong body altogether?
Do you have a cell phone?
Yes.
Providing you dial the right number, does it normally work?
Well, sometimes extra people get on there.
Well, we're talking really about that sort of technology. I think it's fairly, I mean, essentially there you have a wireless network and you're communicating back with a local place where most of the data processing goes on. And we can certainly conceive setting up the same things. And this will be one of the challenges, of course. You didn't bring up the other problem, though, of all these RF electromagnetic fields being generated inside the body. We're not too sure there. Of course, people, that's still up for grabs as to what the actual problems are there, and people are investigating that. But I think the power levels that we'll be looking at are so low that really shouldn't be a concern. Actually, how to make stuff inside the body into a wireless network, there might be a lot of problems there. And there are colleagues in the department, for example, that are experts with radio frequency antenna theory, who've told me that there shouldn't be any problem here. And for example, Dr. Okunevsky in our departments will also be a member of this group. So we're gathering together really experts in all these disparate areas in an attempt to bring some cohesion there. And we're hoping as well to work outside, because the University of Calgary, I'm still working with my colleagues at Windsor. We're hoping to get some really good work going with the University of Alberta. And there's a company in Edmonton, Microline, a world-class company in producing micro structures, lab-on-chip structures right there in Edmonton. Maybe not too many people know about this company, and we're hoping to get some work going with them as well. Maybe they can actually fabricate some of the microstructure devices, the basic lab-on-chip devices for us.
It sounds so incredible. I wish you all the luck, and I hope to be able to check in with you sometime in the future. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And yes, we're certainly being very excited over this, and let's see what happens.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Graham Julian holds the ICOR Research Chair in Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Calgary. ICOR is the Alberta Informatics Circle of Research Excellence. Coming up, a little bit of sunshine makes a pollution-free world. You know it's time to repaint your house when the siding is cracked and peeling from years of exposure to the hot sun. That's if the paint is colored. White paint reacts differently when exposed to ultraviolet light. Instead of cracking and peeling, it turns to dust. It's this chemical reaction that inspired a whole new line of research for Dr. Cooper Langford. A professor of photochemistry at the University of Calgary, his new process could now rid the Earth's air and water of toxic substances.
We start at the beginning by observing that the active ingredient in our photochemistry is titanium dioxide, which is the usual pigment in white paint. And it was discovered quite a long time ago that white paints degrade by forming a dust that is the result of burning off the organic material that binds the pigment to the wall so that the fine titanium dioxide powder falls off.
Is this different from other paints?
Yes, because the titanium oxide, when it absorbs UV light, can initiate reactions of oxygen with all kinds of organic compounds.
So what happened with that discovery?
Well, of course, the paint industry did their best to prevent those reactions from happening. But in the late 1970s, a number of scientists around the world began asking the question, could this be used, since there's a powerful oxidant here, to harness sunlight for useful purposes? And the first idea was to decompose water and make hydrogen. Didn't take very long to really realize that that wasn't going to be economic in the foreseeable future, at least with what we know. And people started looking for other applications.
Now, what are some of those other applications?
Well, if you can start the oxidation by air of a wide range of organic compounds, a very tempting idea is to say maybe we can destroy trace organic contaminants in either air or water that are pollutants that we need to get rid of. And the scheme is very attractive because the titanium oxide oxidations in light can convert almost all organic compounds not to some other toxic organic compound, but straight to carbon dioxide and water.
Now, for the layperson like myself, what really does that mean?
Well, it means that essentially you have a method of rendering the contaminants completely non-toxic. You don't move your pollutant from one place to another. You get rid of it completely.
So what have you been working on then?
There have been several groups that have actually already tried to commercialize the treatment of both air and water with titanium oxide. And finally, the cost of the UV light that was needed to do this at a fast rate has been enough to limit the real attractiveness of this technology. And our specific idea is to get around that limit by combining the titanium oxide with an adsorbent, so that what our system does is first adsorb the organic contaminant on the adsorbent and then expose the more concentrated contaminant material to the UV light with the titanium oxide included on the adsorbent.
Now, the absorbent, is that this white sugary-looking stuff that that we have here?
Yes, it is. The adsorbent material itself is a material called a zeolite. It's a form of silica that, as long as it's very low in content of aluminum or other metals, can adsorb organic compounds very well. It's similar in effectiveness to carbon as an adsorbent for organics, which has been the most popular one in most uses.
How big a step forward is this, or how big an innovation?
Well, we're very hopeful. We still are working on getting our economics figured out carefully. We believe that what we may be able to do is to come in 20% or more below the cost of using carbon as an adsorbent and have the added advantage that we have completely disposed of the pollutant rather than having the problem of what do you do with the carbon after you've adsorbed the undesirable compounds.
Where are you at now in terms of being able to move this forward?
We have launched our first major outside the lab pilot project looking at some taste and odor compounds that are of interest to the Calgary Waterworks using a pilot plant line that Calgary Waterworks has at the Bears Paw plant.
And from there, where do you go?
Well, the other thing that we'd like to do after the drinking water pilot project is to work on some waters that come up from cleaning up after petroleum spills. With the economics that we can work out after we've done these things outside the lab on a moderate scale, we think we will be ready to go looking for investment and industrial partners. We have been collaborating for some years with a company in London, Ontario, Trojan Technologies, who are world leaders in the use of ultraviolet light to disinfect drinking water. In fact, their technology is in use in Edmonton at the moment. And they are a likely partner in that operation. What we would rather anticipate is that we'll be developing a business here in Alberta to manufacture these photocatalytically active adsorbent materials. That is, we'll be doing the chemistry.
Now, where do all of these things come from, the titanium oxide and then also the absorbent material that you're using? Is this something that is readily available in Alberta, or do you have to bring it in from somewhere else?
Actually, the titanium oxide and the zeolite materials are all presently manufactured outside of Alberta. The biggest producer in Canada of titanium oxides is a company in Quebec, as a matter of fact. But where this will wind up probably is a situation in which we will be developing methods to make specific zeolites that are not currently widely available, because we have in our work been able to develop some that are superior to any of the commercially available zeolites for the purposes that we're using them for.
Now, when we look at water purification, is this something that will offer a better alternative to what's already in existence in the systems, or is this something that you will be able to take and apply worldwide, say into some of these third world countries that are having a hard time getting water purification systems set up?
We're hopeful that what will be one of the outcomes of this is the capacity to build an efficient, relatively small-scale system that could be useful in smaller communities here in Canada and indeed around the world. But the most important point is probably that this can deal with some of the compounds that have been a problem for treatment systems at all levels that are presently leading to either some areas of concern where there's not a solution or a relatively expensive solution by having to treat things with carbon adsorption.
Well, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
That was Dr. Cooper Langford, a professor of photochemistry at the University of Calgary. He is also a director of THESIS, the Center for Innovation Studies, and that's something I'll talk to him about on next week's Innovation Alberta. Now let's step back in time for a look at the building of the Brooks Aqueduct. The year was 1912, and just like today, the farmers in southern Alberta worried about how they could ensure a steady supply of water for their crops. For inspiration, they looked back at the engineering feats of the ancient Romans. As historian David Finch explains, that's what gave rise to the Brooks Aqueduct.
Well, southern Alberta was pretty dry then, as it is now, and so what they decided to do was set up an irrigation system, the Eastern Irrigation District. It was the CPR that was behind this idea, but if you're going to have water and move it from one place to another, you have to have canals or pipes or something, and at one point where they needed to move water across a valley, they decided to build this aqueduct, and so that's why the Brooks Aqueduct is there.
Well, the aqueduct is considered an engineering marvel. How long was it and how much work was it to build it?
Well, it's an enormous amount of work to build. This was built before World War I. It was started in 1912, completed in 1914. 3 kilometers long and at places quite high, 25 meters high. And so a lot of concrete went in there, a lot of rebar. And this was done in a time when most of that work was done just by hand. So there were some animals to pull equipment around, but mostly it was men doing the work just with muscle power.
Were there any technological innovations at the time that they had to develop in order to get this thing up and running?
Well, the Brooks Aqueduct was unique in the world. It never had anything been built like it, and never has anything been built like it since. And so they did have to figure out how to make it work and how to – it's suspended on legs up in the air. So how to get all that engineering to work together. So it was fairly technical. It was challenging. The engineers were really quite proud of it. It was an engineering marvel of its time, even if it was somewhat of a maintenance nightmare forever thereafter.
Now, what do you mean, maintenance nightmare?
Well, it leaked from the day it was built. That's just the kind of a structure that it was. The farmers wanted water way into the fall to supersaturate their fields. And so every fall when freeze-up came, the concrete froze wet. And that's not good. That's not good for concrete. It makes it fall apart from the inside out. And so almost as soon as it was finished building, it developed cracks and leaks all the way across the structure. One fellow I interviewed said that when he was a little boy on a hot day, he would ride his horse down to the aqueduct and ride it underneath because there was this gentle waterfall of mist and drips coming down from the aqueduct. So it leaked all the time. And even worse than that, some of the cement would fall out each year, and so every year in the spring before they got it going again, they'd have to get in there and do repairs. So from 1914 until 1979, when they replaced it, they had to continuously maintain and replace chunks of it every year just to keep it operational.
Were people kind of sorry they built it?
Well, I think the CPR was kind of sorry they built it because they ended up selling the whole irrigation project, the Eastern Irrigation District, and the Brooks Aqueduct, and all the other features there to the farmers for a dollar in the 1930s. It's like, let's get rid of this. So they really did want to get rid of it. But the farmers figured out a way to make it profitable. They needed the water. And there was also oil and gas revenues to be had. So the farmers have done quite well off of it.
In the research that you've done for the book that you wrote on the Brooks Aqueduct, what are some things that really stand out for you in terms of what people had to go through to build this thing?
Well, what really stands out for me is you think of big engineering structures and you think of big earth movers and big trucks and big loaders and different things. But what really impressed me was in the construction photographs, these are wagons. These are, you know, mules pulling things. These are men physically lifting everything into place and wiring things together by hand. There's no big equipment involved in this construction. It was really just a human-powered construction of a massive, massive scale, and they moved many hundreds of tons of concrete to get it into place. It's just amazing. It's amazing what you can do.
How did they get the supplies there, like just to make the concrete and get this thing going?
Well, the railway ran right through there, through that area. And in fact, as luck would have it, the railway ran right through middle of the valley where they wanted to cross with the aqueduct. And so they had to build a siphon underneath the railroad. So the water came along and then dove underneath the railroad and then back up into the canal and across to the other side. So the railway was there. And so that's how they moved all the really big stuff to the site.
What is your favorite story about the Brooks Aqueduct?
Well, every fall when they turned off the water and cleaned out the aqueduct, they had to clean out that siphon. And so all the people from Brooks would come out, because guess what? When they drained the aqueduct, all the fish were in the siphon. And so they'd take the door off of the clean out for the siphon, and all these fish would come flopping out. And so that's how people would go fishing every fall.
It was decommissioned. Is it still around?
It's still there, and it's a national and a provincial historic site, and it really is a very interesting feature to go visit. You can get up close. There is a fence around it because it's falling apart. It's not being rebuilt all the time like it used to be, but you can go visit. There's a little visitor kiosk there where they've got some postcards and different things that you can buy about the Brooks Aqueduct, some interpretive signage, and you can walk around it. It's like this great big huge caterpillar standing up, walking across this valley, and so it's a really neat place to visit, and one of its kind.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
David Finch is a consulting historian who writes about the history of Western Canada. And I have 6 copies of his book titled Much Brain and Sinew, The Brooks Aqueduct Story, and you have a chance to win one of these books, complete with some really great photos. Just send me an email describing your favorite engineering marvel. Perhaps it's your attempt to build a better mousetrap or a backyard Taj Mahal. I'll post your stories on the Innovation Alberta website for everyone to enjoy, and I'll pick the 6 winners from those entries. So email your stories to me at cheryl.croucher@ckua.org. And thanks to the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation for sponsoring this Science Heritage segment of Innovation Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website. You can listen to past programs in real audio or download them from the web. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producers for Innovation Alberta are Paul Pates and Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.